Memoirs of the Reverend George Whitfield, Chapter 19. From his opening Lady Huntington's Chapel at Bath to his embarking for America, 1769. Whitfield made but a short stay at Bath and returned to London. January 18, 1766, he writes to a friend at Sheerness, "I am sorry to acquaint you that it is not in my power to comply with your request for want of more assistance. I am confined in town with the care of two important posts, but I am only fit to be put into some garrison among invalids." Early in the spring he was a while revived, for he was in the month of March at Bath and Bristol. He writes, March 17th, "The uncertainty of my motions has made me slow in writing, and a desire to be a while free from London cares has made me indifferent about frequent hearing from thence. Last Friday evening and twice yesterday, I preached at Bath to very thronged and brilliant auditories. A cause of much joy to him about this time was the repeal of the Stamp Act, for he had the colony interests always at heart, and he ardently wished for the restoration of peace and tranquility to his beloved country." We find in his letter book the following memorandum, March 16, 1767, Stamp Act repealed, Gloria Deo. The celebrated Indian ministers, Mr. Mr. Ockham was one of the Mohican tribe of Indians in Connecticut. He was admitted into the Reverend Mr. Wheelock's school at Lebanon when a youth, where he learned Latin and Greek, and a view of the exercise of his ministry among the Indians. He married an Indian woman by whom he had 7 or 8 children, and kept a school on Long Island, where his wife and family tilled the ground. He was ordained a preacher by the Suffolk Presbytery, and was sent on a mission to the Oneida Indians, one of the 6 nations, and afterwards to several other tribes. End of the footnote. And Mr. Whittaker now arrived from America in order to raise subscriptions for Mr. Wheelock's Indian school. That pious institution Whitfield much approved, and concerning it in a letter dated London, April 25th, he writes, "The prospect of a large and effectual door being opened among the heathen, blessed be God, is very promising. Mr. Ockham is a settled, humble Christian, the good and great, with a multitude of lower degree, heard him preach last week at Tottenham Court Chapel, and felt much of the power and presence of the Lord. Mr. Romaine has preached and collected £100, and I believe 700 or 800 more are subscribed. The truly noble Lord Dartmouth espouses the cause most heartily, and His Majesty has become a contributor. The King of Kings and Lord of Lords will bless them for it." Mr. Ockham and Whittaker came afterwards to Scotland and procured very large contributions in the cities of Edinburgh and Glasgow, but especially from the family of Mr. Sprewell of Glasgow and from the Reverend Mr. McLaughlin at Cambuslang. Footnote. It appears from accounts afterwards published that they collected the great sum of £9,494.07. End of the footnote. June 19th, we find him at COLLAM near Bristol, from whence he writes, "As my feverish heat continues, and the weather is too wet to travel, I have complied with the advice of friends, and have commenced a hot well water drinker twice a day. However, twice this week, at 6 in the morning, I have been enabled to call thirsty souls to come and drink of the water of life freely. Tomorrow evening, God willing, the call is to be repeated again on Sunday." From Colham he returned to London. Footnote. About this time Whitfield became acquainted with that faithful servant of Jesus, the Reverend Tory Josh, J-O-S-S. Mr. Josh was a native of Scotland. He was born September 29, 1731, at a small village on the seacoast, about 20 miles north of Aberdeen. Mr. Josh was of a very mild disposition and rather inclined to serious subjects, but these being discouraged at home, He hid his Bible out of the house and embraced every opportunity of consulting it as the guide of his youth. As soon as his age would admit it, he was placed out to a maritime employment. This was a habit of life, not very favorable to religious improvement. But that God who setteth upon the floods can, as Whitfield said of him and the celebrity Captain Scott, afterwards the Reverend Jonathan Scott, being a shark from the ocean and a lion from the forest, and formed them for himself to show forth his praise. The vessel he was in being taken by the enemy, he was carried to a foreign prison, where he suffered extremely. On his return in the year 1746, a date rendered memorable in the British annuals by the total suppression of the Scott Rebellion, he was led by curiosity to view the royal and rebel armies. Here he was impressed and sent on board a king's ship stationed in that coast to cooperate with the land forces. After some time he made his escape, and traveling to Sunderland, bound himself in articles of apprenticeship to a captain of a coasting vessel belonging to Robin Hood's Bay near Whitby in Yorkshire. It does not appear that his morals were injured by the vicissitudes he had already witnessed, nor was it till after this period that he gave evident signs of conversion to God. He was, however, eager to obtain useful learning, and during the winter months when the vessels were laid by, regularly attended by at school to acquire a scientific knowledge of his profession. By a series of the most singular providences, the gospel was brought to Robin Hood's Bay. Many people heard it with attention, and some believed to the saving of their souls. Wesley, on hearing this circumstance, went and soon established a society in the town. Mr. Josh had, previous to this, begun to pray and exhort, and was greatly encouraged by Wesley to proceed. He now joined this newly formed society, and though not an Arminian in sentiment, was ever admitted to the pulpits belonging to that people. He was now about 18 years of age, and became exceedingly zealous. He carried the Savior of his master's name on board, where some heard and others mocked. Waxing strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, he sought every occasion to teach and preach in the several harbors where his vessel lay. His first public sermon was delivered at Boston in Lincolnshire, where God was with him of the truth. When Mr. Joshua was appointed to the command of the ship, he immediately set up regular worship. As often as the weather would permit, he preached regularly to his crew, and before he left the sea, he had a number of sailors who could publicly pray and exhort. Having a flattering prospect of succeeding in life, he was married on Christmas Day, 1755, to Miss Morrison of Whitby, after a mutual and intimate attachment of 10 years. By Mrs. Josh, he had 11 children, only two of whom, together with his mournful widow, survived him. Mr. Josh now looked forward to that period when he should realize a genteel fortune for his growing family. But fortunes depend upon the caprice of wind or weather, and especially when they stand in the way of ministerial duty, our precarious tenure. While he commanded the ship of other proprietors, he never experienced the least disaster. But when he became a joint owner, he witnessed nothing else. In his fourth voyage to London, the vessel was lost at the Nore, and he and his crew were with difficulty saved. He then went down to Berwick to superintend the building of one considerable larger. During his residence at this port, he preached to crowds with great acceptance and success. When the ship was finished and laden, the poor people began to regret the prospect of his departure. The wind was fair, and the next tide he intended to sail. But the next morning it became foul and detained him 5 weeks longer than he intended. After he had sailed, a gentleman of Berwick, unknown to Mr. Josh, wrote to an acquaintance of Whitfield in London, saying what a wonderful preacher they had been favored with for 9 months. He mentioned when he supposed the vessel would be in the Thames. Her name was the Hartley Trader, but the other coasting crews called her the Pulpit. Whitfield, who had seen the above letter, and had heard that the ship had come to her moorings, published, without the knowledge of Mr. Josh, that a captain would preach on Saturday evening. Being found on board, he was apprised of the circumstances and refused to comply. But the messenger resolved not to go on shore till he consented. The services of this and the ensuing evening were so gratifying to Whitfield that he immediately requested him to leave the sea and labor in the tabernacle connection. To these solicitations, he turned a deaf ear, and nothing short of a speaking providence would ever had prevailed. This was his first voyage, and in it he lost his main anchor. On his next return to London, he preached frequently at the tabernacle, which was greatly attended. Whitfield renewed his application. He declined. In this voyage, he lost one of his crew, a promising youth who had drowned. On his third voyage to London, his congregations were prodigiously crowded, and Whitfield pressed on him the duty of leaving in marine time employment and being devoted wholly to the ministry. Mr. Josh had on board a younger brother, a pious man who was very dear to him on many accounts, and thought if ever he should change his views, it would be a good situation for him. He was so far prevailed on as to send his brother this trip while he supplied the tabernacle. But lo, in going down the river, his brother fell over the side of the ship and was drowned. Whitfield then addressed him in a very solemn manner, saying, "Sir, all these disasters are the fruit of your disobedience. And let me tell you, if you refuse to hearken to the call of God, both you and your ship will soon go to the bottom." Overcome by the voice of providence, he yielded. And on his fourth voyage, he quit the compass, the chart, and the ocean for the service of the sanctuary. This was late in the year 1766. Immediately he entered into close communion with Whitfield, who to the day of his death continued to him his affection and entrusted him with his confidence. In this change of situation, he could not have been more actuated by motives of a pecuniary nature, for his prospects in trade were by far more flattering than in the ministry. His sermons in the former years of his residence in town were not only attended by large auditories, but with energy to the conversion of many souls, nor did God leave him without many witnesses to the success of his ministerial labors. He generally spent four or five months in the year out of London for the purpose of itinerating. In this period, he regularly visited South Wales, Colchestershire, Boston Tabernacle, and occasionally other parts of the kingdom. In Pembrokeshire, the Welsh followed him in multitudes, and on the Lord's Day would travel from 1 to 20 miles round Haverford West to hear him. To not a few of these, he became a spiritual father. And indeed, whenever he exercised his talents, though but a few weeks, he left some seals of his apostleship behind. Mr. Josh died of a fever after a few days' illness on the 17th of April, 1797, in the 66th year of his age. During his illness, he enjoyed a solid peace, and the Lord Jesus indulged him with a peculiar manifestation of his gracious presence. Some of his last words were, "Into thy hands I commit my soul. O, the preciousness of faith! I have finished my course. My pilgrimage is at an end. O thou friend of sinners, take thy poor old friend home." The last word he had heard was heard to speak was, "Archangels." In a few minutes after, he lifted both his hands and smiled and died. Mr. Josh was between 30 and 40 years a faithful preacher of the everlasting gospel. Thus lived and died the servant of the Lord, a painful, faithful preacher of his word, ripened in age and steadfast in the faith. Joyfully he sank into the arms of death. His joy upmounted to the realms of day. Let the dark tomb awhile retain his clay, which with immortal blooming joys shall rise when the last trumpet shakes the vaulted skies. End of the footnote. From which place he writes, September 25th, "Many in this metropolis seem to be on the wing for God. The shout of a king is heard in the Methodist camp. Had I wings, I would gladly fly from pole to pole, but they are clipped by 30 years' feeble labors. Twice or thrice a week I am permitted to ascend my gospel throne. The love of Christ, I am persuaded, will constrain you to pray that the last glimmering of an expiring taper may be blessed to the guiding of many wandering souls to the Lamb of God. In the month of November this year, He visited Bath and Bristol. At the latter city, he had very numerous and respectable auditories. Notwithstanding, the weather was extremely bad, and administered the sacrament. And at Bath, he never remembered so large an assembly of nobility and persons of distinction attending his preaching before. About the latter end of November, he again returned to London. In a letter dated December 15th, says, I had been itinerating at Bristol, Bath, Colchestershire, and at Oxford, and humbly hope my feeble labors were not altogether in vain in the Lord. In January 1767, he wrote a recommendatory prefix to the new edition of the works of Bishop Bunyan, as he used to call him, which had been published among his tracts. And March 20, he was called to open Lady Huntingdon's new chapel at Brighthelmstone in Sussex, where he preached on 2 Peter 3:18. After an excursion to Norwich in April 1767, he writes thus, I fear my spring and summer fever is returning. If so, my intended plan of operation will be much contracted. But future things belong to him who orders all things well. Yet, to our astonishment, the very next month we find he preached at Rodborough, Colchester, Haverford West in Wales, from which place he writes, May 31st, thousands and thousands attend by 8 in the morning. Life and light seem to fly all around. On Tuesday, God willing, I am to preach at Woodstock. On Friday at Pembroke. Here again next Sunday by 8 and then for England. And after his return to Colchester, June 10th, Blessed be God, says he, I have got on this side the Welsh mountains. Blessed be God, I have been on the other side. What a scene last Sunday. What a cry for more of the bread of life. But I was quite worn down. September the 11th, he arrived at Leeds. After preaching at Northampton and Sheffield, on his way. And September the 20th, he rides from Newcastle in high spirits. I have now a Blessed Methodist Field Street preaching plan before me. This afternoon in the Castle Garth, tomorrow for Sutherland, and then to Yarmouth. I have been enabled to preach in the street at several places and hope to go to Gashborough, Whitby, Scarborough, New Malton, York, Leeds, Liverpool, Chester, and Manchester. Again from Thamerick, T-H-I-R-C-K, September 28th, my body feels much fatigued in traveling, comforts in the soul overbalanced. And from Leeds, October 3rd, field and street preaching hath rather bettered than hurt my bodily health. The negotiations about the intended college at Bethsaida were this winter brought to an issue. A memorial and addressed to His Majesty was put into the hands of the clerk of the Privy Council, setting forth the great utility of a college in that place to the inhabitants of the southern provinces and praying that a charter might be granted upon the plan of the college at New Jersey. This memorial was transmitted by the clerk of the Privy Council to the Lord President and by His Lordship referred to the Archbishop of Canterbury, to whom also a draft of an intended charter was presented by the Earl of Dartmouth, upon which an epistolary correspondency ensued between the Archbishop and Whitfield, the consequence of which was that His Grace gave the draft of the college to the Lord President, who promised he would consider of it, and gave it as his opinion that the head of the college ought to be a member of the Church of England. And this was a qualification not to be dispersed with, and also that the public prayers should not be exemplary ones, but the liturgy of a church, or some other settled and established form. Whitfield replied that these restrictions he could by no means agree to, and because the greatest part of the collections and contributions of the Orphan House came from Protestant dissenters, and because he had constantly declared that the intended college should be founded upon a broad bottom and no other. They said he, I judge, I was sufficiently warranted to do from the known, long-established, mild, and uncoercive genius of the British government. Also from your grace's moderation towards Protestant dissenters, from the unconquerable attachment of the Americans to toleration principles, as well as from the avowed habitual feelings of my own heart. This being the case, and as your grace, by your silence, seems to be like-minded with the Lord President, and as your grace and His Lordship's influence will undoubtedly extend itself to others, I would beg leave, after returning all due acknowledgement, to inform your grace that I intend troubling your grace and His Lordship no more about this so long depending concern, as it hath pleased the great head of the Church in some degree to renew my bodily strength. I propose now to renew my feeble efforts and turn the charity into a more generous and consequently into a more useful channel. I have no ambition to be looked upon as the founder of a college, but I would fain act the part of an honest man, a disinterested minister of Jesus Christ, and a true Catholic moderate presbyter of the Church of England. He now determined upon mature deliberation in the meantime in the addition of a public academy to the orphan house similar to what was done in Philadelphia before its college charter was granted, and to embrace the first favorable opportunity that might offer of making another application for a charter on a broad bottom. The steps he took in this affair are more fully narrated than the limits of our present plan would admit. In a letter to Governor Wright, in a letter to his intimate friend Mr. Keene, he complains, "None but God knows what a concern is upon me now in respect to Poseidon. As another voyage perhaps may be the issue and result of all at last, I would beg you and my dear Mr. H. to let me have all my papers and letters, that I may revise and dispose of them in a proper manner. This can do no hurt, come life or come death." October 28th, he preached at the Tabernacle to the Society of Promoting Religious Knowledge Among the Poor, and he collected, after sermon, upwards of £100, above four times as much as usual, and besides gained 80 new subscribers. His text was Luke 11:2, "Thy kingdom come." The place was so full that many went away who could not get in. Several dissenting ministers of different denominations were present, perhaps more than ever before attended to hear a clergyman of the established church preach. He afterwards dined at Draper Hall with the ministers and the whole company, who treated him with great respect. The time was spent in the utmost harmony, which gave him much pleasure and reflection. Early in the year 1768, six pious students were expelled from St. Edmund Hall in Oxford for praying, reading, singing hymns, and exhorting each other in private and religious meetings. The following is an extract of a letter from Oxford, inserted in the St. James Chronicle for Thursday, March 17, 1768. On Friday last, March 9, 1768, six students belonging to Edmund Hall were expelled the university after a hearing of several hours before the vice-chancellor and some of the heads of houses for holding methodistical attendance and taking upon them to pray, read, and expound the scriptures and sing hymns in a private house. The principal of the college, the Reverend Dr. Dixon, defended their doctrines from the 39 articles of the established church and spoke in the highest terms of the piety and an exemplariness of their lives. But this motion were overruled and a sentence pronounced against them. Dr. Dixon observed that as these six gentlemen were expelled for having too much religion, it would be very proper to inquire into the conduct of some who had too little. And the vice-chancellor was heard to tell their chief accuser that the university was much obliged to him for his good work. The following are the names of the young men, with the names of those who passed sentence on them. The sentence was pronounced in the chapel. James Matthews, Thomas Jones, Joseph Shipman, Benjamin Kay, Erasmus Middleton, and Thomas Grove. For the crimes above mentioned, we, David Durrell, D.D., Vice-Chancellor of the University and Visitor of the Hall, Thomas Rudolph, D.D., President of CCC, Thomas F.O.T.H.E.R.G.I.L.O., D.D., Provost of Queen's College, Thomas Noel, D.D., Principal of St. Mary's Hall, and the Reverend Thomas Atterbury, A.M., of Christ Church, Senior Proctor, deemed each of them worthy of being expelled the hall. I therefore, by my visitorial power, do hereby pronounce them expelled. Footnote. This event occasioned a long and unpleasant controversy, in which Dr. Noel and Sir Richard Hill Bart were principal combatants. The apology offered by the friends of the expulsion was that the young men had broken the statutes of the university, which would have been pleaded with a better grace had the same zeal for discipline appeared in the expulsion of a few young men for swearing, gaming, and intoxication, which were certainly not less irregularities than exemplary praying, singing hymns, and expounding the scriptures. The issue exposed the university to a great deal of ridicule, particularly in the Shaver, a Sermon, which was written by the late Reverend John McGowan, and was not only very popular at the time, but has gone through 20 editions. Dr. Horne, Bishop of Norwich, also wrote, "In the defense of the students, according to the Reverend Dr. Noel's learned answer to Sir Richard Hill, it is evidently much more safe and less impetuous to ridicule the miracles of Moses and of Christ than to pray in private houses without book." The eloquent orator of the university gives a full account of the case of Mr. W., a friend of his oratorships, who was charged upon oath with the above said contempt of the scriptures and ridicule the miracles of Moses and Christ. The proofs were so point blank against the said Reverend Mr. W. that his reverency could not deny the charge. Well then, what was the issue? Was he expelled? No, he was not. Query, why not? He was not expelled. Answer, his reverency pleaded his being drunk when he uttered those contemptuous words against the miracles of Moses and Christ. The candidacy for holy orders was drunk when he ridiculed revealed religion, and yet he got into orders, and yet he continues a member of the university. In the same affair related by the Reverend Dr. Durrell, it is plain that private religious assemblies, alias conventuals, are in much less esteem at Oxford than tap houses and taverns, for the six Methodists were expelled for praying in a conventual, but the Reverend Mr. W. could get drunk in a tap house and yet continues a member of the university. Nor can this be denied unless the public orator should eat his words, or otherwise show from good and authentic records that members of that learned body do occasionally get drunk within their own peculiar districts. Here it may be proper to observe that the college in Wales ceased at her ladyship's death, the lease being just expired and no endowment being left, her income dying with her, but a new college on a plan more promising for literature has been established at Chestnut in Hertfordshire near London, and under the superintending care of trustees appointed for that purpose. A number of students have been already educated there, and many are gone forth now preaching the gospel with much acceptancy from this seminary. End of the footnote. Upon this occasion, Whitfield wrote his letter to Dr. Durrell, Vice Chancellor of the University, in which he observes that however criminal the singing hymns in a university might be deemed, the same practice in a camp was not thought reprehensible by a noble general. The late Duke of Cumberland, who went in Germany, happened one evening to hear some voices from a cave at a little distance, asked the sentinel what the noise it was. He was answered that it was some devout soldiers who were singing hymns. Instead of citing them to appear before his officers, ordering them in the habitures to be whipped, or commanding them to be drummed out of the regiment, he pleasantly said, "Are they so? Let them go on, then, and be as merry as they can." In this he acted wisely, for he knew and found by repeated experience, as did other commanding officers, that singing and praying in these private societies did not hinder, but rather fitted and animated these pious soldiers to fight their country's battles in the field, and it may be presumed that if these students had not been expelled for singing hymns, etc., they certainly would not have been less, but in all probability much better prepared for handling the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, and fighting therewith, either from the press or the public, the battles of the Lord of hosts. In the summer he went the last time to Edinburgh, and there the congregations were as large, attentive, and affectionate as ever. Soon after his return to London, Mrs. Whitfield fell ill of an inflammatory fever and died on the 9th of August. On the 14th, he preached her funeral service sermon from Romans 8:20. And September the 12th, he writes, "I have been in hopes of my own departure Through hard writings and frequent preaching, I have burst a vein. The flux is in a great measure stopped, but rest and quietness are strictly enjoying. He were favored with glorious gospel gales this day fortnight and several preceding days. In his memorandum book, he wrote as follows, August 24th, 1768. Open good Lady Huntington's Chapel and College in the parish of Falgarth, Merkinickshire, South Wales. Footnote. Here it may be proper to observe that the college in Wales ceased at her ladyship's death, the lease being just expired, and no endowment being left. Under the footnote, preach from Exodus 20:24. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. August 25th, gave an exhortation to the students in the college chapel from Luke 1:15. He shall be great in the sight of the Lord. Sunday, August 28th, preached in the court before the college, the congregation consisting of some thousands, from 1 Corinthians 3:11. Other foundation can no man lay than that is laying, which is Jesus Christ. Thus we see him incessantly doing the work of an evangelist. Well would it be for the Church of Christ if there were more of his brethren inclined to follow his steps, even as he followed Christ. Concerning his dear departed friend and fellow laborer, Mr. Middleton, he writes September 26, he is now made perfectly whole. He was carried from the tabernacle last Wednesday evening, and a subscription opened for his four orphans. In the midst of his torturing pains, being asked by his daughter how he was, answered, a heaven upon earth. Soon afterwards he fell asleep in Jesus. The latter end of this year we find his health very much impaired. Yet though in much weakness, he continued to preach as often as he was able. Bristol, November 12th. Last night, I hope, the Redeemer manifested forth his glory. Friday evening and the following Sunday, I shall preach at Bath. In 3 weeks, I expect to reach London, unless called before that period to reside at the New Jerusalem. A promising prospect lies day and night before me. Thus, this good and great man found unceasing pleasure in laboring in his master's vineyard. While plans and infirmities brought his body low, and his soul was exulting in the expectation of speedily entering into everlasting rest, it pleased the Lord in the ensuing spring, 1769, to restore him a little, so that he was enabled to preach oftener than he had done for some time past. His joy was now much increased by the addition of some noble members joined to Lady Huntington's society. Some more coronets, I hear, are likely to be laid at the Redeemer's feet. They glitter gloriously when set in and surrounded with a crown of thorns. About midsummer, he preached at Kingswood, Bristol, Bradford, Frome, Chippenham, Roddenborough, Castlecombe, and Dursley. But intending to open Lady Huntington's Chapel in Dunbridge, T-U-N-B-R-I-D-G-E, he did not go his western circuit at this time. July 23rd, 1769, he opened Lady Huntington's new chapel at Tunbridge Wells and preached from Genesis 28:17. There is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. The congregation being too large to be accommodated in the chapel, he preached out of doors from a mount in the court before the chapel, after which he gave a general exhortation, and the next day administered the Lord's Supper and preached from Thessalonians 2, verses 11 and 12. He now began seriously to prepare for another voyage across the Atlantic to visit once more his beloved orphans and friends at Georgia. Accordingly, at the beginning of September, he embarked the seventh and last time in the Friendship Captain Ball for America. From on board he writes, I am comfortable on every side, a civil captain and passengers all willing to attend on divine worship and to hear of religious things. End of chapter 19, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.